Number 25-2184, Jose Ramiro Mejia Henriquez against Attorney General. Mr. Nolet?
Thank you, Judge Hardiman, and please the court, and we'll just note it's great to see. Hoya is very well represented in the courtroom this morning. As Judge Hardiman noted, my name is Joel Nolet. I'm from Wiley-Ryan in Washington, D.C., and I am pro bono counsel for petitioner Jose Ramiro Mejia Henriquez in this case. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
According to the record in this case, torture in Salvadoran prison is pervasive, widespread, deliberate, and systemic. And those publicly suspected of gang membership, such as Mr. Mejia Henriquez, are at the highest risk of experiencing this systemic torture. But the immigration judge denied Mr. Mejia Henriquez's request for a deferral of removal under the Convention Against Torture, which the BIA summarily affirmed. Given the record, the agency could reach this result only by disregarding the overwhelming record evidence and by misconstruing and misapplying the governing legal standards.
Before you get into the merits, could you talk about mootness? Your client has been removed. Is he still housed at El Peñalito?
He is not. He's been ECF number 27-2. We included a record that we were able to get from the criminal proceedings in the case against him in El Salvador, and he has since been moved to the prison that is known as San Luis Mariona or La Esperanza.
La Esperanza, okay. But he's not at CECOT.
That's correct.
Okay. All right. Well, but tell us why the case is a live controversy in light of the fact of his current residence.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. Four reasons in kind of in descending order. First, in this court's decision in Pia Chacon Villegas, particularly footnote 5 of that decision, that was a deferral-only case. And the court explicitly held that the fact of the petitioner's removal from the country, I believe he was a Colombian in that case, but he had been removed from the country. And this court explicitly held that the case was not moot under the collateral consequences exception to mootness. I'd also point out, second reason, it appears that the four circuits that have squarely considered this question all have agreed that in cat deferral-only contexts, removal from the country does not moot out a case. I would point this court in particular to the Fifth Circuit decision just last year in Aguilar-Quintanilla, when very similar circumstances. It was a Salvadoran who was removed. I believe the stay of removal was denied in that case and was removed to El Salvador. Upon his removal, the government took photos of him on his knees, depicted between two soldiers and prison officials, branded him a terrorist, and said that they were actively going to seek justice against him. And the Fifth Circuit found that there was no mootness in the circumstances. The third reason, I just point this court to the Supreme Court's decision in the Chafin versus Chafin case. It was a slightly different context. It was a Hague Convention, a child custody dispute, but many of the very same considerations that arise in that deferral-only context once somebody has been removed from the country. The court articulated the standard that it had articulated before, that in this context, the requirement is impossibility of effectual relief. And in that case, the court found that there was, quote, no law of physics that would prevent relief. So no matter how doubtful, no matter how uncertain effectual relief would be, the case was nevertheless not moot. So, and the fourth reason that I'd provide, Your Honors, is that this court does have the authority to order the facilitation of his return, and by virtue of that authority, effectual relief is available.
All right, but there seem to be collateral consequences required, right? It can't be an idle exercise that he's brought back to the country. That would just be a waste of time and money for everybody and give your client false hope. So there has to be sort of some chance, right, that he be returned. Tell us your dream scenario, how, you win across the board. How does he get relief and get back here?
If we win and, it was a full reversal because he is, this court decides that he is entitled to cat relief on the record, then, the government has every interest in ensuring that CAT is enforced, that people are not, you know, in countries where they're subject to torture. And so the government has every interest in facilitating his return. Short of that, you know, even if this was a reverse and remand situation for further consideration, you know, in particular, given given the state of affairs that has happened since he's been removed, the fact that he's been detained in San Luis Mariona, which, you know, as the record reflects, some of the worst abuses that are going on in El Salvador right now are happening in that prison. You know, one of the highest rates of in custody deaths is happening there. We'd you know, likely explore reopening, or you know, if the, you know, the agency has significant discretion to decide how it wants to conduct the proceedings from there, and we would argue that he need to be brought back for in-person testimony.
And is he being held on the charge that you argued he would be facing if he got back there? Is that why he's being held, or is he just being held because we returned him?
It is the extortion charge. Yeah.
What?
The extortion charge. The indictment that was the subject of some back and forth in the administrative proceedings, but as well as the public news articles that publicly identified him as an MS-13 member involved with that infamous politician and that extortion scheme. It is those proceedings.
Yeah. While we're talking prerequisites, can you please walk us through your theory of jurisdiction in this CAT-only appeal in a case where your client didn't challenge the actual final order of removal?
Well, under Nasrallah versus Barr, we can. Nasrallah versus Barr recognized that under the CAT 2242B, that a CAT deferral only case can be challenged under 1252A.
So you think it's that simple? It's just a straightforward application in Nasrallah?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Unless there are any further questions on the subject of mootness, to pivot to and focus on the issues that we raised in our briefs, I would like to focus in particular on the issue of the agency ignoring material evidence to the CAT claim. If time permits, and of course, as the court would like to ask questions otherwise, I'm happy to address the other subjects. But to discuss the issue of the agency ignoring the evidence. You know, this court has recognized.
I want to try to set that up for you to help you and for us to have an efficient conversation about this. We see this argument made frequently that an agency ignored evidence, right? And I think the quotation from your brief was the agency, quote, ignored voluminous record evidence. That's at page 30 of your brief. And the way that charge goes is that because the IJ's decision or the BIA's decision didn't say thus and such, the inference is that it ignored it. I've never quite understood why it's the logical inference. That sort of asks us to presume that everything that the agency does write about was ignored. So it's sort of asking us to give a presumption of irregularity to the proceedings in the agency. And I'm inclined to give it a presumption of regularity that if the judge or the board was awake and paying attention and listening, the fact that something isn't mentioned in an opinion, but it was part of the record, why wouldn't we just accept and assume that it was considered, just not mentioned in the opinion?
Well, the issue is not not simply a failure to explicitly state. You know, this court, of course, has recognized that a treatise doesn't need to be written, you know, exegesis on every single data point. But in cases where, as here, the record evidence is distorted, mischaracterized, overlooked based upon what the IJ did write, you know, it falls within the four corners of many of this court's decisions.
All right, well, misconstruing, et cetera, is not ignoring. Ignoring is ignoring, that's different. So tell us, maybe it's fruitful to start with where the agency misrepresented or misunderstood the record. Why don't you start there then?
Gladly, Your Honor. So, you know, to start, one, the recurring refrain in the IJ's decision was that this was a poor prison conditions case. The IJ used that term multiple times. It cited to this court's decisions in August versus Ridge and Dennis and Pierre that were all these Haitian poor prison conditions cases where, you know, it was very clear there was, quote, no evidence, this court said in those cases, that the conditions were deliberately being perpetuated motivated to inflict severe pain and suffering, which is the requirement under CAT. And there's no word. There was passing reference, which is very similar to what, you know, the IJ did in Pia Chacon Villegas, which this court found problematic, very similar to what the agency did in the Quinteros case that this court found problematic, a passing reference to generally the country reports and country conditions evidence. But again, to the IJ, this showed prison conditions, when in fact the record evidence, I mean, even the State Department report talks about the systemic torture happening in
What does systemic torture mean? I mean, I think we can agree on these facts. Correct me if we can't. Under the state of exception, the Bukele regime has incarcerated upwards of 80,000 people. The regime has indicated that some 8,000 were released as deemed innocent. I believe as many as 350 have died in prison. So what does systemic mean? Does that mean that 80,000 people are tortured? Does that mean 40,000 people are tortured? Does that mean 1,000 people are tortured? What does that mean?
I mean, just to use some language from some of the reports in the record, taking the releasees, you know, one of the ways in which the record was distorted, the IJ looked at 7,000 releasees as if this was somehow evidence that, you know, there's not a significant enough problem going on. You know, the reports reflected that everyone that these human rights organizations talked to, you know, including hundreds of releasees, they all attested either to what they themselves had experienced or what they, you know, were firsthand eyewitnesses to on a daily basis. Quantification is a challenge in this context, but it's a challenge because of the active suppression of information. Again, it's reflected throughout the record.
But that sounds like you're asking us to write an opinion that's sort of big that says there's systemic torture here. You haven't really linked up your guy's situation. You haven't linked up Mejia Enriquez, that he personally is going to be tortured. The fact that some people are tortured, let's assume that some people are being tortured. That doesn't tell us anything about whether Mejia Enriquez will be tortured.
Yeah, so we don't think the court needs to write a, you know, big opinion, whatever precisely you mean by that.
Well, systemic, your word. That's why I said big. I mean, if the case is, we know from the evidence that your client will be tortured for these reasons, then we can focus on that. But I don't hear you telling us, other than sort of vague assertions that he's a gang member and he has tattoos, but meanwhile his tattoos are about his family. They're not, we see MS-13 tattoos all the time, or Calle 18 tattoos, and he doesn't have any of those. So is this case about your client's specific facts, or is this case about the conditions of El Salvador and prisons at large?
Well, you know, and let me be clear, I by no means mean to run from what the record shows, which is that the conditions in Southern prison are, I mean, hell is the word that is used repeatedly throughout the record, describing conditions that are there. And I don't mean to run from that at all. That said, this is a case about Mr. Mejia Enriquez, and we have put forward arguments for what his particularized risk is. In particular, I think, you know, most saliently is this very public accusation. It was in the national news media that linked him up with this infamous politician, Raul Mijangos, was his name, who kind of led this extortion scheme, and Mr. Mejia Enriquez was indicted as one of the co-conspirators.
Let me ask you, you didn't challenge the credibility determination that the IJ made.
That's correct, Your Honor.
He was found not to be credible.
That's correct.
So are we to assume that really if he was found not to be credible, the only thing that this case is about is the country conditions? Because what else is there? I mean, if there's this negative credibility determination, if we're looking at country conditions, then this issue is whether or not anybody can go back to El Salvador who's going to face prison.
Well, it's the country conditions evidence as well as, again, you know, I believe there were four different news articles in the record that went unchallenged. In fact, the IJ, you know, although he questioned the indictment about this extortion scheme, and there was some issue over that, there was no question that these news articles, in fact, the IJ, you know, affirmatively found that Mr. Mejia Enriquez was likely to be arrested, you know, by virtue of what those news articles demonstrated, you know, purely objective evidence that was in the record identifying him, you know, face, depicting him, and linking him up with this alleged extortion scheme that was being run, again, by this very famous politician. And, you know, that in particular is, you know...
Did the IJ find that part of his testimony credible?
Which part? The part that
he was linked to this politician, or are you saying that that documentation is sufficient to... supplement the country condition reports.
The IJ found that that documentation was enough. The IJ affirmatively found he was likely to be arrested upon arriving in El Salvador because of those news articles. You know, again, he had concerns about the indictment, but even
But getting arrested, charged with a crime, that doesn't get you anywhere.
But a very high-profile, you know, extortion scheme with this infamous politician who, as Dr. Bishop noted in her report, has since died in prison.
If this infamous politician had 10 guys that were extorting people and six or eight of them got sent back to El Salvador and all six or eight of them were tortured, now you got a pattern. Now you got a very credible argument that, well, it stands to reason the same thing's going to happen to Mr. Mejia Enriquez. You don't have anything remotely like that. Right.
Again, you know, what the record does reflect is that getting information on detainees is incredibly difficult. One, the Salvadoran government has deemed confidential every single one of the criminal cases that's taking place under the state of exception. In addition, the government is actively refusing requests that it is required to comply with to provide information. It has prohibited, like the Human Rights Ombudsman in El Salvador.
All that goes a long way to saying that you're unable to prove your case because of the dearth of information.
Well, we have. It's
you want us to take the dearth of information and say that there's some adverse inference that causes you to win the case under some presumption because of the dearth of evidence?
No. It's not that it's we win by virtue of a dearth of evidence. It's that taken together, what evidence is available, which is tip of the iceberg. It's at least
the evidence available is that 350 people have died in Salvadoran prisons. It's a reasonable inference that. Some of them were sick. Some of them might have been tortured. Some of them might have been killed. Who knows? But that doesn't tell us whether, 350 out of 80,000. I don't want to minimize the 8,000 innocent people that were released, but even the 8,000 innocent who were released, is there evidence that they were tortured?
Yes, Your Honor. I'd point you to, I believe it was the El Faro article about the school teacher who was rounded up.
Right. How many of the 8,000? How many of the 8,000 innocent that were released have credibly said, I was tortured? My point is it seems episodic, and I don't know that there's anything in the record that has tied episodes of prison mistreatment or even torture to your client's case.
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, again, what evidence that organizations have been able to develop, the State Department has acknowledged, provide credible information there is that can be ascertained. They have interviewed hundreds of releasees. They have spoken to, they've gotten funeral records. They've spoken with families to the extent that families have been willing to discuss. Many aren't because they're afraid of the government and whatnot. They have cast as broad a net as imaginable to then, systematize and make, make informed judgments with the, the incomplete information they have. And what they have determined is that, these conditions in Salvadoran prison are systemic. It's, the torture is systemic. It's widespread. It's pervasive. To the extent that is not enough, it is at least the baseline upon which Mr. Mejia Enriquez's CAT claim is established, which is that he, more so than your average state of exception detainee, faces, he is at the highest risk of facing that systemic widespread torture that's happening in Salvadoran prison because of, again, the particulars of his own background, his criminal history.
How does that fit into our tests from Pierre, the Pierre case?
With respect to the...
What you've described is, he's in a category that might be more likely. Doesn't sound like that's specific information about your client.
Well, again, Your Honor, because he's been publicly named, identified as an MS-13 member in national news, and linked up with this infamous politician, again, who has since died in custody in El Salvador, that is... That is exactly what Pierre said would be needed, what August and Dennis and you know, this court's cases have said would be needed, is that sort of, you know, particularization.
Does that distinguish him from anyone else who is alleged to be a member of MS-13, who may be fighting, seeking cat relief in this country?
Well, again, I mean, the particulars of his case are this, this very high-profile indictment linked up with this very infamous politician, not just some, you know, some random MS-13 gang member. It's, you know, he stands out among, let me put it this way, to, you know, to state it succinctly. Mr. Mejia Enriquez stands out among the group of individuals that are at the highest risk of facing torture, you know, where the baseline is systemic and widespread torture taking place.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Nolet. Mr. Weisberg?
Good morning. May it please the court, Mike Weisberg for the Attorney General. This petition is moot, and even if not, it should be denied. A petition for review challenging only a denial of cat protection from deportation is logically mooted by deportation. Because such a petition doesn't concern the underlying removal order, there are no collateral consequences at play. That's at least true in the absence of some executive branch policy of facilitating return from deportation and treating the petitioner as if he had never been deported. So courts have held that when the ICE directive 11061.1 applies, that a case might not be moot, and I'm willing to assume that's right, but it has nothing to do with this case for multiple reasons. On page 41 of petitioner's opening brief, he conceded that the ICE policy doesn't apply. ICE would not facilitate petitioner's return because he's detained in El Salvador. And I've confirmed with DHS that that's true. The facilitation of return policy is about providing a travel document, coordinating with CBP. It's not about securing release from foreign custody. So this—
But if we granted cat relief, that might change.
Actually, the facilitation of return policy itself, when it does apply, it contemplates a future grant of cat relief. Like a future grant of cat relief is the minimum for the policy to potentially apply, but it doesn't apply to a someone who's detained on foreign soil. In fact, expressly, the policy is just, we'll give you a travel document.
But I mean, you could see a string of possibilities, perhaps not likely, but he might cease to be detained. He might be released tomorrow. He might be tried and found innocent.
So
there are myriad possibilities, right?
Right. So a couple things on that. The classic formulation for avoid mootness is that the petitioner continues to suffer an injury that's likely to be redressed by a favorable judicial decision. A possibility isn't enough. Spencer v. Kenma, Supreme Court decision, says we deal in likelihoods and probabilities, not mere possibilities. This court's decision in the Berkey v. Marbury says the same thing. There needs to be a concrete expectation that something like
Okay, well, if he wins the cat claim and he's sitting in Salvador in prison on an extortion charge, isn't it likely that he'll be released at some time? I mean, are you saying that it's likely that he'll do a life term because of an extortion charge?
My point is that I have no idea, and it needs to be.
So there's a possibility.
A possibility is not enough. Like the Supreme Court has been very clear on that. There needs to be a concrete reason to expect that circumstances will change.
Does the department have any specific information on where he is and why he's being held currently?
Working on that. Don't have info from DHS yet. Willing to accept their filing saying that he's held pursuant to this extortion charge. If anything, I think that helps us. It shows that he is detained. It reinforces the mootness point. And Judge Hardman, to your question, I think another way to sort of frame the mootness inquiry is to be effectual, the relief that this court needs to provide has to have either a present or non-speculative future effect. And the effect that you're talking about well, the criminal proceedings might change, is quintessential speculation. But even if you disagree with me, I still think this case is moot. Even if you think that he would be released, like acquitted and released in El Salvador, I think one of your honors mentioned sort of the dream scenario, right?
You said you're working on it.
Yeah.
How long do you think it would take you to get information that could be used to supplement the record?
I was hoping to have it by this morning, so hopefully I'll have it soon. And as soon as I do, I'll notify the court.
Did you intend to move to supplement the record with that information?
I intend to provide the court with any relevant information.
Okay.
Yes. But just to be clear, my mootness argument doesn't exclusively hinge on his ongoing detention pursuant to foreign criminal proceedings. The facilitation of return policy has an extraordinary circumstances exception. And in the cases that have held that the facilitation of return policy saves a petition from mootness, the government has represented that the petitioner would ordinarily or probably have his return facilitated under the policy. Here, it's the exact opposite. It's extremely unlikely that this petitioner would have his return facilitated. The exception to the policy, it contemplates national security concerns. And also, as the 10th Circuit recognized in Igibor v. Barr, an ongoing prosecution would also be a separate ground. So he, in theory, he could be released pending trial in El Salvador, right? So what I'm saying is national security concerns because he's a suspected member of a foreign terrorist organization. But then also he could still be subject to foreign criminal proceedings.
You can't have it both ways. You can't say that he's not an MS-13 member because his tattoos are of his family, but he is an MS-13 member when you want him to be.
I'm not having it both ways. I'm saying for mootness purposes, the fact that he's a suspected MS-13 member is a national security concern that doesn't that would render
that was a news. Has he been charged with that? I thought he was charged with extortion.
He was charged with extortion in El Salvador, but according to petitioner's counsel, he was identified as an MS-13 member.
In a news report. That's not evidence.
No, Your Honor, in ICE facility, and he was moved within that facility. This is in the record. He was moved for his own safety within that facility. Now, they didn't press that argument before the agency, so that fact, so the IJ and the BIA didn't err by giving limited weight to this idea that he's a suspected gang member. But we can still recognize it now for mootness purposes and say, and I've confirmed with DHS that it's extremely unlikely that a suspected terrorist would not only have the ICE policy apply, but then be paroled back into country by CBP. And just to give the court clarity on how this works procedurally, the ICE policy doesn't control CBP. So for someone to actually be physically returned to the country, ICE would have to determine that its policy applies, but then CBP would also have independent authority not to parole that person back into the country. So you would need two sort of separate components of DHS to decide that it's in the public interest and it's not an extraordinary circumstance to facilitate the return and parole back into the country.
You're making the broad argument then that any time someone is removed from the country and they have a CAT claim pending, the case is going to be moot.
I'm not making that
because argument. CBP might. There's a substantial chance CBP is not going to let them back in the country.
No, there's a substantial chance that CBP won't let a suspected terrorist back in the country. And
can you speak to how the petitioner's criminal record factors into that analysis for DHS?
Absolutely. Criminal history, both in the United States and in El Salvador, can both be extraordinary circumstances for purposes of the ICE policy and can be a reason to deny parole with CBP. And often is a reason to deny parole by CBP. So what we have is not...
Let me just ask you, may we only consider lawful entry when we look at the consequences? What if he sneaks through again?
So,
I mean, it happens.
Right,
it might happen
right.
again in the future.
Right. You know? The Supreme Court has said that in Spencer v. Kenma, that a mootness argument that hinges on the person who's arguing that a case is moot, that hinges on them breaking the law, is not a valid argument to avoid mootness. I think there are Supreme Court decisions about, well, you know, my challenge to my parole revocation, it's not moot because even though I've served the full underlying prison term, it's not moot because if I get arrested again and if I'm on trial again, that parole revocation could be used against me. The Supreme Court has said that's way too attenuated and it hinges on, you know, you committing another criminal offense.
Okay.
So you can't consider that. The classic collateral consequence is when it's not just a pure challenge to CAT deferral, it's a challenge to a removal order. And there's a collateral consequence of inadmissibility. You're barred from returning to the country for 10 years. So even though you're already out, your petition has real concrete consequences.
Just not sure. Spencer's a habeas case. I'm not sure we should import that into the immigration context or assume that it applies as a perfect match in the immigration context. Do you have any immigration cases that help us with this mootness question?
Well, I think there are a few on a few different levels. So I guess out of circuit, you've got Fifth Circuit and Ninth Circuit have indicated that when the ICE facilitation of return policy is at play, deportation of someone challenging.
When it isn't at play.
Correct.
But
and it's not here.
How do we know it isn't at play here? That's the problem. That's an unknown that I'm wrestling with.
Yeah.
I look at the ICE policy. You haven't revoked the administration, the current administration hasn't revoked 11061.1, has it?
Right. That's correct.
So the beginning of it says may continue to litigate their petitions after their removal from the United States. But I guess your initial argument was that what comes before that is aliens who petition the Circuit Courts of Appeals for review of their administrative removal orders. And your argument is that he did not petition this court for review of his administrative removal order?
Well,
he petitioned this court saying that
right.
There was an error in denying him CAT relief.
That's correct.
And that's a critical distinction here.
It is a distinction. I want to be completely, completely candid.
We appreciate that.
Yeah, yep, good. Well, when I read the ICE policy, I don't think it applies to CAT deferral at all because of what you just said. When someone brings a pure CAT deferral claim, the text of the policy clearly doesn't apply. It also speaks to treating the alien as having been restored to their status before, having reverted to the immigration status he held, if any, prior to the entry.
Where in the policy are you reading
this? This is in the middle of paragraph 2. ICE will regard the returned alien as having reverted to the immigration status he held, if any, prior to the entry of the removal order. CAT deferral doesn't do that. CAT deferral is protection from removal. It has no bearing on the validity of the underlying removal order. If you're granted CAT deferral, you're still
so that's subject. Further textual evidence that this does not apply to CAT only claims.
Right, but the problem, Judge Hardiman, in candor, is that in the past, ICE has applied the equivalent policy.
So we've got a course of dealing that seems inconsistent with the plain language of the directive.
Exactly, but to your question about the text, paragraph 3.1 defines what it means to facilitate an alien's return. Issuing a boarding letter to permit commercial air travel, and if warranted, parole the alien into the United States. The accompanying FAQs make clear that is the extent of the policy. You get a travel document, and we will basically coordinate with CBP so that if they're not gonna let you in, we'll tell you or your counsel it's not worth you buying a plane ticket. So again, there's sort of two component steps to that process. And my opinion is that when someone's detained, when someone's a suspected member of a foreign terrorist organization, when someone has petitioner's criminal history, there is basically a zero chance of them being paroled into the country unless there's some overriding national interest, like if they were gonna testify in a huge criminal trial against some kind of kingpin. There's nothing like that in record. And to be clear, there's also, this court also can't order the executive branch to return someone to the country in those circumstances. I think the...
Well, the more fundamental thing is that we can't order a foreign country to release someone from the criminal justice system.
Exactly, exactly. I think there would be two big problems with that. Ordering a foreign country to release someone from their criminal justice system, but also, given the foreign terrorist organization angle, it would be interference with the executive branch's authority over national security. So I think I would anticipate the counterargument would be the Supreme Court's Abrego-Garcia decision. Completely different situation, because there, the Supreme Court treated the initial deportation as an unlawful executive branch action that the court needed to unwind. And here, it's undisputed that the initial deportation was lawful. And the Supreme Court's decision in Munaf v. Guerin, 2008, speaks to the exact point you made, that courts can't issue orders that would intrude on the sovereignty of another country's ability to prosecute crimes committed on that country's soil. And that was even as to American citizens. So if that's the rule, American citizens, certainly the rule for petitioner.
All right, well, we've badgered you about mootness, so let's give you a chance to make some argument, assuming that we disagree with you on the mootness point.
Sure. So from what I can tell up until today, petitioner's argument was that anyone detained in El Salvador, or at least any suspected gang member, cannot be returned to El Salvador. I don't think the record compels or even supports that absurd and dangerous result. Now, of course, I acknowledge that there are some broad statements in some of the country conditions reports calling torture systematic or part of a protocol, or in some spots even suggesting that all detainees are tortured. Every single one of these statements, if you read them in context, it's just a hyperbolic, conclusory inference drawn from anecdotes, or it clearly lumps in treatment that is not torture within the meaning of CAT, but that people are colloquially calling torture, or it just relies on leveraging statements by public officials that are clearly expressing moral disapproval of gang members or serving other political purposes like deterrence. And of course, the tough on crime policy in El Salvador is very popular. So I think this is a great case to clarify the mootness law in this area, but I also think if you disagree with me, it would be a good case to follow the Fifth Circuit's lead in Fuentes Pineda v. Bondi. They approved the BIA's decision in matter of ARR, basically running through a very similar set of facts. In fact, there the petitioner was definitely MS-13, was a convicted murderer, and the BIA walked through why these types of country reports aren't enough to even support a finding of CAT relief. And I think the Fifth Circuit in Fuentes Pineda also pointed out that these types of like Amnesty International reports often just represent one side in a sharply contested debate. They're not especially probative. The State Department report is much more probative. And by the way, if I could just quickly circle back to mootness, when we're talking about speculation about things that could change in the petitioner's detention or ongoing criminal proceedings, just remember there's one other factor that would need to stay the same for him to get effectual relief, which is that he would still need to be eligible for CAT deferral. So that it's very easy for the agency to go back to the IJ and say, CAT deferral, like circumstances have changed, he's not eligible. If he's in a position where he can take advantage of and return to the United States, the current country conditions report for El Salvador says that there aren't significant systemic human rights abuses going on there. So he would have to overcome that as well. It's just another link in the sort of speculative chain. But I understand we're focusing on the merits now. So I would just say matter of ARR, the BIA's decision, really walks through this well. The Fifth Circuit has approved it. This court should approve it as well. And if there are no further questions, we ask that you dismiss or deny the petition.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Weisbuck. We'll hear rebuttal from Mr. Nolet.
Thank you, Your Honors. To start, just one point to clarify on the jurisdictional question, I just want to confirm that the way that this was structured, the way that we did it in this case, is that we did petition for review of the final order of removal to raise the CAT deferral claim, which is what Nasrallah, the scenario that Nasrallah addresses. As far as the return directive goes in the discussion. That,
when did you do that? In the IJ, before the IJ?
In the petition for review before this court. So under 1252, what gives this court jurisdiction to Judge Bowie's question about this court's jurisdiction?
So you think just a naked reference to a final order of removal in an appeal or a petition that otherwise focuses exclusively on CAT is enough to invoke our jurisdiction under 1252?
Yes, because again, that's exactly what FARA is, the statute, right, that implements CAT here in the country. And as Nasrallah versus Barr explained, is that this is precisely the mechanism, is that under 1252A, this court has jurisdiction to review final orders of removal.
I think those cases say when there's actually a challenge to the final order of removal, not a petition styled as such without any arguments about the final order of removal and only CAT arguments. So I think you're asking for an extension of Nasrallah, and maybe there's a basis for it, but I don't think it's as simple as you're suggesting.
Again, that is, at least that's the mechanism that Nasrallah explained.
That's the mechanism you've invoked.
There's a significant discussion about the return directive in the government's argument as well. I would just want to point the panel to footnote 4 in the government's brief in response to what we said in our opening brief. The government pointed to its return directive and said it's up to it. It has discretion to decide whether or not to invoke it. And so the government itself, in its brief, put it on the table in response to what we said in our opening brief. As far as the substantive discussion about mootness and the standards for mootness, again, I would put this court to the Chafin versus Chafin case from the Supreme Court. That again, it was a very analogous scenario. It articulated a standard that effectual relief has to be impossible. It used the phrase that no law of physics that would prevent relief from being available. And so it was. The court even acknowledged that
your friend says it has to be likely. Any possibility under the law of physics and likely, that there's a chasm between those two. Why is he incorrect about that?
Because again, the standard for mootness in this precise context is that impossibility standard. That,
what about the law of comity in respecting the foreign law proceedings in El Salvador?
I'd point this part to the Fifth Circuit's decision last year and Aguilar Quintanilla. Again, that's one of the four circuits, all of which that have addressed this question of mootness have said that CAT deferral only claims are not moot following the removal of the person to the country. And in Aguilar Quintanilla, the Fifth Circuit again acknowledged that the man had been branded a terrorist upon removal, imprisoned, and there was a press release with his picture saying that he would be brought to justice in El Salvador. And the Aguilar Quintanilla court found that even in that factual circumstance, there was not mootness.
You're not arguing that we can order him released from a Salvadoran prison, are you?
No, Your Honor. I'm not arguing that.
So the directive would only have potential effect if and when he's released from a Salvadoran prison.
Which is more than enough, again, under this court's mootness standards. In Chafin versus Chafin, again, the Supreme Court talked about scenarios involving deportees and involving foreign nations where relief would be uncertain, admittedly uncertain. The Supreme Court said, yes, that might be true. But again, going back to the impossibility standard, it said the case is not moot, even though those things might happen in those contexts, that relief would be uncertain. Mr. Mejia Enriquez, has been charged in this extortion conspiracy. The charge alleges a very minor role that he had, and of course, it's a charge that he has denied, he is actively defending. I'm out of time.
Go ahead.
Answer. Just a few more points, very very briefly. The government stood up and called Mr. Mejia Enriquez a terrorist. I believe that there's anywhere in the record where that was that language, except perhaps for the mere fact that he's been suspected of being an MS-13
member. Those two are linked now by administration policy, aren't they? Hasn't MS-13 been designated an FTO?
I'd have to look to confirm, but that may be true. But even so, you know,
he's linking it to MS-13, and you did. Do you have a response to his charge that you yourself have told us that he is believed to be a member of MS-13?
He is, yes, that is, according to the record, right, he is suspected of being affiliated with or a member of MS-13. That is true. But again, you know, I'd point to the Aguilar-Tania case for purposes of understanding, how this all affects the mootness analysis, where somebody was actually affirmatively branded a terrorist upon removal by the Salvadoran government, and the Fifth Circuit did not find mootness in those circumstances.
If we were talking about Al-Qaeda or ISIS instead of MS-13, would you have any basis to stand here and ask us to direct the executive branch to facilitate the return of a member of one of those FTOs?
The extraordinary circumstances exception refers to serious national security concerns and serious foreign policy concerns.
We should decide, or you should decide, whether the president's FTO designation is serious. It's on paper. It looks pretty serious to me.
Let me just point to the Fifth Circuit. I can provide the it's. I would encourage you for it. It's Aguilar-Quintanilla, just last year from the Fifth Circuit. Worse facts as far as who the petitioner was. And I believe in that case, actually, the government agreed with the petitioner that the case was not moot. But in any event, the Fifth Circuit went through the analysis, given that it is jurisdictional, and agreed that the case is not moot, despite even more a more dire factual scenario than what we have in this case.
Anything else?
If there are any further questions from the panel,
I think we're you've done a good job. Telling us everything we need to know in conjunction with Mr. Weisbuck. Arguments have been very helpful, and the court will take the matter under advisement. Thank you.